Welcome to the Fundraising Leadership Podcast, where we engage in lively and thoughtful conversations with professionals in the nonprofit world. I'm Janice Cutting, and I'm here with my partner, Margaret Katz-Kan. Hi, Margaret.
Hey, good morning.
And we are excited to have Kathy Mann back again. She was previously on the podcast way back, episode 56, talking about values create fundraising success. And Kathy is back today to talk about another juicy topic, social change philanthropy. And Kathy is well known for many things, including being the president of the Fundraising Lab. So Kathy, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me back. I'm delighted to chat with you again.
Yeah. So tell us before we jump into your topic, just briefly about the Fundraising Lab and what you do.
Yeah. So we are a fundraising consultancy. We work mostly in the realm of social change philanthropy. So most of our clients are working with clients who are vulnerable or marginalized, not always the easiest sort of fundraising causes to raise money for. In addition to consulting, we do strategic planning and help people implement and execute on some of the recommendations that we make. We also have some online offerings. So on October 17th, our flagship program, Planning with Purpose, starts up. It's an 8-week program, and it really walks you through the nuts and bolts of developing your fundraising plan with an aligned budget and getting buy-in throughout the organization. We also have a fundraising community for people to be able to access some of the resources that we create on a regular basis, but also to network and connect with each other for that sort of peer support that is so important in our sector.
Great. And Kathy, I really enjoyed reading the blog that you wrote on sort of laying out this difference between more traditional fundraising and how we need a different paradigm, I guess, to really think about raising money for social change. And would love if you tell us, you start the blog with a story that's quite allegorical. Would you be willing to share that to kind of orient people?
Yeah. So I start this the story with a parable. I don't know if it's a parable, but it's maybe it is an allegory of.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. I'm not sure I could define those two things and how they're different. That's the next blog.
Yeah. That's right. Somebody from Webster's Dictionary can come on. So it's a story of a woman standing by a river, and she sees somebody floating down the river who isn't able to get himself out of the river. She jumps in, pulls him out of the river. Next day, same thing happens. There's a stream of people floating down the river. People set up a little encampment area to pluck them out of the water and bring them to safety. And finally, someone says, why are people floating down the river in the first place? Goes to the headwater and tries to prevent them from, falling into the river in the first place. And I think that is a good allegory for describing social change, right? So we're trying to prevent things from starting rather than just providing Band-Aid solutions. And while the allegory is really great for describing social change, it didn't really cut it for describing the nuances around social change philanthropy. So what does it mean to raise money when you're working in an organization that is trying to affect change, when in fact the very your efforts to raise funds, especially if you're working in the world of major gift fundraising, you may be speaking with people who benefit from a system that is set up the way that it is. And if you're trying to change the way the systems are set up, what does that mean for fundraising, and how do you approach philanthropy? And what does it mean about the differences for fundraising compared to some of the more traditional fundraising that we see in our sector?
Yeah, I'm super curious. What was you talked about that before founding the Fundraising Lab, that you yourself have worked in many social change organizations? And I know this is sort of a simple question, but what's the problem? What is it that's not happening, or what's the frustration? Or
So, you know, I think, oh boy, how much time do we have? So, you know, there's a few things. I mean, one of the challenges is that lots of social change organizations are small. Mm-hmm. And so there are these small organizations that don't have a lot of resources that are trying to address enormously wicked problems, enormous and enormously wicked problems. And they're operating on a $2 or $5 million or $500,000 budget.
Or 80,000. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So there's only so much that you can do when you have a small budget. And so one of the challenges is that many social change organizations are small, work within an industry or a sector that is quite fragmented because we're small and we don't necessarily have the capacity to come together so that our voices can be bigger and louder. And I think that is a really significant issue. There are not many large organizations that are addressing social change issues. Now, that's not exclusively true. I mean, there are some big ones that we, you know, there's Amnesty and of course I've forgotten the other one that's at the top of my tip of my tongue. Sure, there are some big ones, but I would say that so many of the clients that I work with at Fundraising Lab and who I worked with before I started my consultancy tended to be on the smaller side with smaller budgets, and we're trying to really change the world with like a tiny drop in the bucket.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like when you were talking, you know, about the river, one thing that sort of struck me was, I mean, when we feel overwhelmed, it's hard to even have that thought we should go to the start of the river and find out why people and right? And I think that's often the challenge with these organizations, like many organizations, right? If we think of food insecurity, for example, it's like, how do we, like, there's a crisis, like people literally need to eat, right? But then there's all the sort of systemic reasons why we are in this situation. And it is so complex, right? To think about, like, some organizations are meeting the need and some organizations are trying to change the system so the need doesn't exist. And many organizations, frankly, are actually trying to do both, you know, which is even more complex.
Yeah. And so it's interesting from a really practical point of view. I have spoken with people who work in food insecurity, and I won't name any names because I don't want to protect the innocent. But, you know, I can think of examples of colleagues of mine who have said that raising funds for things that are kind of traditional and really easy to understand. So a food bank, we're going to feed people. That is easy to understand. It's visceral. You know, we've all experienced like hunger, even if it just means, you know, like we skip lunch. So we understand that. And then the challenges that they face when they try to take more of a systems approach to it, and the challenge in raising funds to address systems change versus dealing with the problem. And so, you know, Margaret, back to your earlier question, part of the challenge is that it's not always easy to get donors on side to deal with complex problems. I think one of the lines in the blog is that, you know, people expect short-term and simple solutions to long-standing and complex problems. And it's hard to get people to buy in to what is probably a long and arduous, messy and nuanced system to get, or process to get to change.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories about this, and I'll give credit to Kim Klein, who's an author and tells the story of when she was on the board of a nonprofit and they were trying to raise, I think it was $1 million. I'm not sure exactly what the amount was, but for an environmental thing. And they went to the person they thought was going to be their best donor. And she, you know, she listened to their pitch and she starts shaking her head, no. And she's like, I'm not going to give you one thin dime for that. And, you know, there's silence and breathless, like, oh, no. And finally, somebody got their breath back and said, oh, okay, can you give us some feedback on why? And she said, you can't solve that problem for $1 million. You know, like, you're not, you start thinking about something that actually feels like it might make a dent in that problem and come back and talk to me. And I love that story because I think it's so applicable. You know, we forget to think big sometimes with our donors when we...
Yeah, we forget to think big, but here's the corollary to that, I think, is that, you know, more and more research is showing that systems change can happen at a community level. And investing in communities doesn't necessarily require multi-millions of dollars, or a million or two would be awesome. But I can think, you know, I credit East Scarborough Storefront and Center for Connected Communities in the blog post. They're an organization that I worked with for many years and volunteered with, and they are like Hotel California. You can stay, but you can never leave, or you can come, but you can never leave. And they are doing such phenomenal work in the world of community. So really demonstrating how you can make significant changes at a community level, and then that can be adapted in other communities. So there's sort of a like domino effect. But you're right. I mean, you know, sometimes there's this expectation that the big, hairy, wicked problems can only be addressed at the highest levels, when in fact, sometimes the most innovative solutions are identified at a community level.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's actually, there's, I don't know if either of you have seen, but there's this great show called Life Size City, which is an urban planning kind of documentary show. And, you know, Google it if you want to check it out, listeners, but it's really about what you're talking about, Kathy. Like this guy goes around to different cities and meets with the people who are on the ground, like doing, like they're taking over parking space and building a little garden and just inviting the community to come. You know, they're just like redoing a kid's playground with like the most simple sort of things that they already have, like open streets, things like that kind of stuff. And it's really inspiring, like, to see. And that's exactly it. It's sort of like, once that happens, it opens up this way of people saying, oh, like, that's possible, right? Like, so when I was listening to you, like, I was thinking about, for you, like, how do you help your organizations tell that story in a different way to donors? Because I think part of the challenge that you get at in the blog is like, we haven't always done like such a good story, a job, I think, as fundraisers, like telling donors about new and different ways of doing things. So how do you help your clients do that?
Yeah, so that's an interesting one, because it's not easy, right? And so what we've been taught as fundraisers is that we have to distill these complex issues into simple narratives to make it easy for donors to understand and to inspire donors to want to get involved. And I think to a certain degree, that's still part of the solution, but doing it in such a way that that doesn't like underestimate donors' intelligence. And I'll tell you, I spend a lot of my time, I call myself a translator. Like I spend a lot of my time trying to understand what my clients do and then telling it in a way that anybody who's listened to any of my blogs or masterclasses, you know, I tell the story often of my mother. Like my mom was a really intelligent woman, but she had to leave school in eighth grade during the Depression to work to contribute to the family income. So she didn't have an extensive vocabulary. She understood complex concepts, but they had to be delivered in clear language. And so what happens too often is that people get, look, jargon can be very evocative, for people who understand the jargon, but it doesn't mean anything to my mom. So I always say, would Tina understand this? And how can we talk about what you're doing in such a way that Tina would understand this? And we get caught up in jargon and we get caught up in using terms like, respectfully, intersectionality, and like my mom wouldn't have known what intersectionality was. And so how do we use the principles of clear language to describe the work that is being done? And so that really does require people to take a bit of a pause and allow somebody to come in and reflect back to them who they are, and then try that on and, you know, adapt it. But I have lots of conversations and sometimes even heated debates with my clients around, you know, language and how they can describe who they are and what they're doing in such a way that's going to make sense. And so here's the thing. I see lots of organizations trying to deliver the message of the most enormous change that they're trying to effect. And I'm usually like, yeah, nope, mom wouldn't have understood that. But I love this direct mail analogy where, you know, for homelessness, we know that the biggest population that experiences precarious housing is often young women and children. And in fact, it's a growing population of people experiencing precarious housing or homelessness. Yet if you send a direct mail letter out to prospective donors telling the story of a young woman and children, the cognitive dissonance, the discomfort, the inability to absorb that or want to believe that's the case can be overwhelming. And it's hard for people to accept that. So can you tell a story that is still true to the cause, you're operating with integrity, but that will be absorbed by the audience a bit more easily? So I always say, like, try to be where people are, not where you want them to be. Begin the relationship and then deepen the relationship. And then you can get more in depth and more nuanced about the mission as you have a stronger relationship with your donors.
Yeah, I love what you're pointing to. It's such a fascinating fascinating process to find that sweet spot between, you know, really colossal problems that have giant urgency and the thing you're describing, which is the shutdown, you know, this human nature to, like, that's overwhelming. You know, I don't feel like I'm going to be able to make a difference in that one.
You know, I learned that lesson before I became a fundraiser. So before I got into fundraising, I was an executive director of some small youth serving organizations. And a friend of mine from university saw the United Way campaign or the United Way commercial on TV in Montreal. That's where I lived at the time. And I remember seeing it and I was like, oh yeah, what a great ad. And he saw it and he was appalled. He's like, I don't want that kind of image while I'm watching, you know, while I'm eating dinner, watching TV, how dare they show that to like kids might be watching. He was just outraged. And I remember thinking, well, for the first time I've seen an ad that really kind of addresses the reality of the issues that we're facing. And so to me, that was like, that's almost 40 years ago that I had that conversation with this guy, and it stuck with me. And I think that is what really influenced me when I've been when I work with clients to communicate who they are and what they do, because it's such a delicate balance between engaging new people and bringing them into the fold and just turning them off. And as I said, once you have a relationship with your donors, then you get to have different and more complex and more layered conversations with them.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. Like, I like that you said that, because there is a way, you know, I mean, if we think of a major gift donors, for example, like often they are very influential in the business space, which is very complicated. I mean, you know, you talk about complexity theory. Obviously, every business is really living in complexity more and more. And I'm also curious, like thinking about that, like, do you think there's more openness with your clients and with donors, like, because you have, you know, a unique sort of vantage of having both points of view, like through COVID, do you think that the kind of acceptance of complexity and desire to like embrace complexity has changed?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, yes. And I think the question is, will it continue? And I think we're still, that's still to be seen. But I certainly saw that some major gift donors of clients of mine stepped up in a big way for the clients that I have that work in homelessness and food insecurity. And it's, you know, like it, I haven't done enough, you know, I haven't done any research. This is all just gut, but like, guess what happened? The media told the stories that we've been trying to tell for years about the clients that are already, or the people who are already most vulnerable, and how this thing that affected all of us affected them much more significantly. And so part of it is that, you know, the stories were being told, and they were being told by sources that, you know, like, it's not just each small charity trying to tell their own story. It's like national media telling the story and shining a light on all of the issues that those of us who work in social change have always known exist. But, you know, folks who don't have access to this world were finally given a peek behind the curtains from a different, the person who was delivering the message was different.
And right.
Trusted source. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and perhaps had no perceived vested interest, right? Like, it's one thing for me and my clients to be saying, oh my goodness, this is why, these are the issues with homelessness, or these are the struggles that we're facing around food insecurity. You could imagine that, you know, we have a vested interest in delivering those messages to, if you're super cynical, to feed the, you know, nonprofit industrial complex. But when media is telling the story and they don't necessarily have anything to gain from a charity raising more money to help its clients, yeah, maybe it is seen as more credible,
less biased, kind of. Yeah, I hear what you're saying.
Yeah, it's like it's on the 6 o'clock news. It's kind of a, like, talk about meeting people where they are, right? Like, sometimes it's like, if it's on social media or in the newspaper or on the news, like, it sort of feels different.
I just want to say, maybe this is an oversimplification, but it strikes me that, you know, one of the reasons marketing works is because it tells a message and repeats that message. And to a certain degree, the media telling the story was the best marketing of some of the social change issues that we have experienced during, when they were telling it during COVID. And it got repeated a lot. Mm-hmm. So it stuck in people's minds. And so that's why I say it remains to be seen whether or not that will continue post COVID, whether or not we can continue to inspire people to want to, like, engage in complexity and go on that really messy journey without the sort of guarantee of this linear relationship between you invest this much and we're going to deliver this thing over here. Because, as I said in the blog post, like, there's no linear journey. It's, hey, come invest because we think that if we do these different interventions, they may or may not result in this thing at the end. But hey, won't that be a cool experiment? Because, you know, our gut's telling us, and the work that we've done in community is telling us that this is going to work.
It's so interesting to me too, like, how, you know, when you think about technology companies, like, they raise so much money based on just these sometimes outlandish ideas that have, you know, very little behind them sometimes, you know, it comes out later. And yet somehow in philanthropy, like, we don't kind of feel permission to do the same thing, right? Just to have a big dream and to have like an intuition, or, you know, maybe there's some research pointing us there, but not enough yet, but it's an experiment. Like, you know, there's some kind of disconnect, right?
Yeah. I love what you're pointing to, Janice. I mean, and I live in a community and raised money in a community that is very entrepreneurial. You know, it's a sort of a little, you know, mini Silicon Valley here in Boulder, Colorado. And I wonder, I mean, we, you know, played with this. I'm not sure we totally nailed it, but this, yeah, it's Janice, what you're saying, like giving yourself permission to say it's a risk, right? Like there are no promises. And, you know, it's just what our best plan is, you know, here's why we think it will work. And being okay with those kinds of conversations.
I mean, I think that you're sort of touching a little bit on, you know, some of the principles around community-centered fundraising talk about the kind of relationship that you have with donors. And I appreciate that about community-centered fundraising. I think that we have been taught to defer to donors, and to and that they we don't share the whole truth of our organizations and of our missions. And I think that, you know, in social change philanthropy, with my clients who are really embracing this, they get that donors are partners, and having partners doesn't mean you only tell them what they want to hear. It means you invite them along and share with them the highs and the lows, and share with them the things that are successes and the things that didn't work out quite the way that you had expected.
Yeah. And, yeah.
You know, Margaret, you asked a question earlier about are we seeing a different, or I don't know who asked that question, but, you know, are we seeing donors being more willing to engage in complexity? And I've been working with a group, an Inuit group, and what I'm really excited about with them is that from the outset, we talked about wanting to create a philanthropic approach that was based on Inuit values. And so we're building that as we go along, and we're at the very early stages, and I'm so excited to see where that leads us. And I have learned so much about, you know, how to look at philanthropy differently, and how to take a stand. So taking a stand also means being prepared to say no to some donors. Like, you know, we're saying this is the framework within which we want to have a relationship with a donor. And if you're not interested, then I guess maybe we're bless and release each other, and we'll go on our ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is. I mean, that's one thing that I'm really taking away from this conversation is, yeah, that there has been an opening. Things are always evolving, but I think the pandemic heightened that. And like you said, Kathy, like a spotlight was shined, and yet it's very easy to go back to how things were. That's just human nature, right? And so, you know, I'm curious, maybe if, you know, if somebody's listening and they work in social change philanthropy and they're excited by what's possible, like what would be advice that you would give them to seize this moment, like give themselves permission and really seize this moment?
So first of all, I would say if you actually talk about the work that you do in the context of social change philanthropy, please let me know. I can't tell you how many times I talk about social change philanthropy and I see blank eyes staring back at me, because it's not a term that's widely used. It's a term that, you know, I think I tripped across it in a book that Simone Joyeux had recommended to me about a decade ago. And I don't know that we, and you know, I will say that until I heard that term and started to think about it and started to do some writing about it, I didn't know I didn't understand how to position or frame the frustrations that I was experiencing as a fundraiser. And so that And then when I, you know, discovered David Snowden's complexity theory lens and how that applies to philanthropy, for me, it was like, it was a huge relief. I was like, oh, okay, this is what it is. Yeah, that complexity is the thing that changes everything. So if somebody is in social change philanthropy and you know it, that's awesome. If you suspect that maybe you are, or if this sounds like it, you know, like it resembles the work that you're doing, I would say definitely read the blog, because I think the blog that I sent you guys is a really lovely primer. And yeah, read the blog. Check out community-centered fundraising principles, because I think that while there are, I kind of love how my interpretation of it is that social change philanthropy is this sort of a framework, and those community-centered fundraising principles are kind of like how you apply the framework. But I think that that the two of them operate in isolation of each other. And I'm not suggesting that you need, you know, that I am the end all and be all, but I think having a framework about why social change organizations are different does add a little bit of richness, and perhaps makes it easier to understand the differences. So I would say read the blog. If you are involved in the CCF movement, go and, or if you're not, go and read those principles, and just start to think about, talk about the work in terms of complexity and how it impacts philanthropy.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, and don't forget to apply the TINA standard. Is that your?
Yeah, you know what? The litmus test is, will TINA understand this? And so, I mean, you know, what I say is, who's your TINA? Right, because probably many people have their own version of my mom in their lives, and so I will often write something and then leave it for a day and come back and think, would mom understand this? And I actually told the TINA story when I was doing a presentation, and then one of my slides said, fundraising is not a panacea, and somebody in the back of the room said, I don't think TINA knows what panacea means. And I was like, oh, you're right. She wouldn't. And why did I, you know, oh my goodness, I have to change. I have to change it. So I still get caught out writing in ways that TINA wouldn't understand. But fortunately, people are gracious and pointed it to me.
Gracious is certainly one word for that.
That's funny. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, that's good. Yeah, that's a great something to try. And you also have some links in the blog, which is nice. Like, so the, you know, read the blog and start to think about, it feels like one of those things where it's like, if you suspect that, you know, this is what's causing your confusion, then you're probably right. And really, I mean, when you think about it, every fundraiser should be striving for social change. You know, I think some organizations are more, obviously, you know, working in the social change space, but, you know, whatever kind of fundraising you're doing, this is definitely something that you want to think about and apply the principles to your own work. And
one more thing that just quickly, you know, I interviewed Jennifer Bernard, who's the CEO of Women's College Hospital Foundation in Toronto. I interviewed her for my podcast. If you want to listen to a conversation about the intersection of traditional philanthropy and social change philanthropy, I asked her that question because Women's College does engage in so much social change work. And so we had an interesting conversation about, you know, being in a hospital that where she could do nothing but very traditional philanthropy, but where she also was applying a social change lens to some of the philanthropy that she did. So that would be an interesting listen to if this has piqued your curiosity at all.
Yes. Yeah. Can you send us that link, Kathy? And then we'll put that in the show notes. Yeah. Because I don't know if I've heard that one. So I want to go back and listen to that. Yeah. That's a perfect example, right? Where it's like, yes, it's healthcare. And yet people I live in Toronto. So I'm, you know, I have an awareness of Women's College, and it's like, it's really taking like a feminist perspective. Healthcare, right? And challenging the ideas of, you know, what we think of as healthcare and what kind of care women are getting that is very different in terms of, you know, not only care, but research, more important. So that's a perfect example. I'm so glad you added that. So, yeah. And so, Kathy, again, remind us when your course is happening and how people can sign up for that.
Yeah. So if you are wanting to create a kick-ass fundraising plan and a budget and figure out how to engage your internal constituents, like your board and your, you know, colleagues, you can take Planning with Purpose. It starts on October 17th, and you can get more information at fundraisinglab.ca.
Great, great. And I think one of the reasons we love talking to you and having you on, because we have a very shared value in community. Like we all love building community spaces. And that's an incredible resource for people. So yeah. Thank you again, Kathy and Margaret. Yeah. And
thank you for your thoughtful, I feel challenged by thinking about some of the things that you've presented. So that's a gift. Thank you.
Well, thank you for letting me talk about something that I love talking about and that I don't always get a lot of opportunity to chat about it. So thank you so much.
Yeah. And is your podcast coming back? Wasn't it on hiatus or is it back?
It was on hiatus. We are, it will come back in a modified format. Yeah.
Okay. We'll look forward to
that.
There
are some episodes out there that have come back. We just are being low profile about it right now until we get back up and running.
Sorry, it's a lot of work, as Margaret and I know. So, okay, great. So we're going to remind you, the something to try this week is really to dig into the blog, think about how the concepts of, you know, social change philanthropy and complexity theory relate to the work that you do. And then also, as I said, there's some links to additional resources that you can check out. And we have a free resource this week. And I was thinking it's starting to feel, well, it depends where you are. For some people, it is back to school. Here in Canada, back to school is coming. Everybody's in on vacation, it feels like, the last couple of weeks of August, or doing their last minute trips to the cottage or whatever. But back to school is coming. And so if that makes you get into the learning mode, then we have a free resource called the Nonprofit Leader Reading List. So you can check that out. We'll put a link in the show notes. And if there's any books that you've read recently, listeners, come on social media and comment. We'd love to keep adding to that list. So thanks again, and we'll see you soon.
This podcast is brought to you by Fundraising Leadership. We provide unique coaching and training programs that powerfully transform how you work in order to get results. Please subscribe if you haven't already. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. If you are enjoying the show, you can help us continue to bring thoughtful content with a monthly or annual contribution. This supports our production costs and keeps the show ad-free. Make a contribution today using the link in the show notes. Now, go put it into practice. Yeah.